It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. If you feel like society these days has gotten more rude, you're not alone. According to the 4th Annual Civility in America survey, 70% of Americans feel that incivility has reached crisis levels in this country.
And here to talk about that with us is PM Forney. He's the director of the Civility Initiative at Johns Hopkins University and the author of The Thinking Life, How to Thrive in the Age of Distraction, as well as two other books on good manners and civility. PM, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
So according to this most recent civility survey, it was done recently, 70% of us think that we are in crisis mode when it comes to incivility. That's a pretty big majority of people. I mean, do you agree with that response? Are
Yes.
we at a crisis level?
Yes, and these figures that are appearing in these searches of opinion are pretty consistent, have been pretty consistent over the last the last 10 years or so. Americans believe that incivility is a big problem, that is a national problem, and they also believe that things are not getting better, they are getting worse. Now, we can talk perhaps later of whether this perception coincides with the truth, but certainly Americans, more than any other time in the history of this country, are convinced that they are living in a rude environment day in and day out.
Well, let's jump right into that issue. Is this a matter of perception, or do you think there's some reality there, that we are really more rude?
I think there is a reality, and there are ways of measuring that. One is whether we care about what others say of our actions, or the perception of our actions from others. And this, in the 1950s, until the 1950s, the ratio of people who believed a lot that what others thought of their actions is changed to 70%.
Well, that's a lot of people. I mean, one of the things I struggle with, though, is if 70% of people think that we're getting ruder, that's a majority of people. Presumably, some of those 70% are also rude themselves.
So that's right. And in fact, if you ask Americans, do you think that Americans are rude? Six or seven Americans will say, yes, I think Americans are rude. But if you ask them, do you think that you are rude? In about 99.9% of the cases, the answer is no. So I think the mathematics there is a little bit fuzzy.
So we're very sensitive to other people's incivility, but we don't care enough about it to set an example ourselves?
That is one thing that is very common. We are very prompt at complaining about how others behave, especially if how their children behave, we are not very accepting of the criticism that comes from others.
Well, what do you think the internet has to do with all of this? Because, you know, we spend a lot of time online. There's all these anonymous ways to contribute our thoughts, and lots of times those thoughts are not expressed very politely, to put it very mildly. Do you think that a lot of the incivility that we feel in our daily lives is just coming from the internet?
There is no doubt. The internet is a very informal medium that happened to an already very informal society. And this makes it so that we are rude a lot of time or very often on the net, because we spend so much on the net, and our children spend a lot of time on the net. So now, of course, we don't want to. We cannot eliminate the net from our lives, and I'm far from saying this, but because the net is also very important and wonderful tool, but it has also become the place where the moral toxins of our societies go. We need to have the courage to say that the net is a good thing, but it can also be bad. And because people, as you mentioned, think of the anonymity and think that they can get away with things that they could not get away with in the life and in the real world. And so the net becomes this free-for-all, and that is not pretty.
Well, we'd like to hear from you. Do you think we're becoming more incivil as a society? Are you seeing more and more rudeness, or do you think it's been the same all along? Do you think the internet is making us rude, discourteous? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR. Interested in hearing your stories, your solutions to incivility in America. Again, 800-642-1234.
And PM, what do you think, you know, we should do when we encounter incivility? It seems like the majority of us are feeling it. We're feeling it at work. We're feeling it when we're out and about. What's the proper response when someone is rude?
Well, it depends. It depends, first of all, if the person who is rude to you is a person of your circles of acquaintance and friends or family, or whether it's somebody you do not know. If it's somebody you do not know who is rude to you, it pushes aside on a line at the airport, you don't have to respond. If you want, you can just continue with your life and ignore it. When, instead, the act of incivility comes from someone who is part of your family, your children, one of your children, your spouse, and they do something that hurts you, then things are different. Because I would advise, and I always advise, I've been advising people to do this for the past 15 years, to speak up, not in a violent way, but in a rather deliberate way, you have done this yesterday. You were supposed to pick me up at 4 in the afternoon, and you didn't come, and you didn't call me that you were not coming. Now, this is something that is true. That is a fact, and nobody can change it. So first you say what happened. Then you say to the other person, when you do this, you make me feel that you don't care about my time. And finally, the closing statement of this strategy is, I trust that in the future, if you are late, you will call me.
All right, PM, thank you.
The reason for this, the reason I say that it's better to speak up with the people with whom we share our lives is because if we don't say anything, they will continue to do it the next time. And there is the next time, and the next time again. And someday you're going to explode.
PM, thank you so much for joining us. I don't mean to be rude. Your phone line has just been going in and out a little, so we'll let you go at this point. But thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us today on incivility.
Okay.
That was PM Forney. He's director of the Civility Initiative at Johns Hopkins University. He's written books on manners and civility, and his latest book is called The Thinking Life. Now we want to hear from you.
And we're wondering about what you think. This new survey that we're talking about says 70% of people think that incivility in America has reached crisis levels. People are quitting their jobs because of incivility. They think it might be leading to violence, and that we, in general, just have an incivility problem in this country. And we want to know where you've encountered it in your life and what you do when you encounter incivility, or maybe you're guilty of being rude to someone. Why do you think it is that this is kind of running away with us? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're at Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking now about incivility in America. According to a new study, 70% of Americans think that in America right now, we are in crisis mode when it comes to rudeness. And we want to know about what you do when you encounter incivility. Do you think we do have an incivility problem in the United States? And where is it coming from? Is it all down to the internet? Is it our personal choices? What's happening? Maybe new technologies like the cell phone are changing things as well. What do you do when someone is rude to you? And are you rude? 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also go ahead and post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Colin with us in Madison. Colin, hi. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I grew up in Toronto, and I've lived in Europe also. I've been to France and Germany, England and Russia, and in my experience, America is the most friendly place that I've been. When I came to Madison, I walked down the street, or I drive down the street in the neighborhood, and people that I don't even know will just wave and say hello. And you would never do that in Toronto, and certainly never in a lot of places in Europe.
Do you find...
I will say, though, that I think that people in Europe are a lot more hospitable when you come into their homes than people in America are. But generally, for people that you don't know, especially out on the streets, I think that America is a lot more friendly, maybe civil.
And Colin, do you find that Wisconsin in particular, or do you think it's a nationwide thing?
Well, I spent some time living in Minnesota, and of course I've traveled around the U.S. I think that Wisconsin is more friendly than a lot of the other places that I've been in the U.S., but still, I think that the U.S. in general is more friendly, aside from a lot of metropolitan areas like New York and L.A., et cetera.
All right, Colin, thanks a lot. Interesting observations there and the comparisons, too.
And we'll go ahead and take Eric next. Eric's calling from Endeavor. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Hey, quick point on his call. I've lived in Southern California. I've lived all over the United States. And usually places where, like where I live now, I live in a very small village, and people talk about people in California like they're horrible and rude. When I lived in L.A., the people were way more polite there than they are here. The people here are awful.
Oh.
But the reason I call this is because I'm rude to people all the time. I don't use the internet, and I'm very careful when I text because you can't really hear what I'm saying in a text with my voice inflection, so I'm very careful not to be rude. But as far as in public goes, as a kid, I got walked on all the time by being too nice, and like you said earlier, people don't want to hear criticisms of themselves, so you kind of have to put it real bluntly so they don't turn it around in their head and make it something else. So, yeah, I'm pretty blunt now.
Well, I guess that raises the question. I mean, do we have to be rude now to get by in society because things are just shifting, like you said? Do you think that you do have to learn to be blunt, or at least have that in your toolkit?
Yep, I don't enjoy it, and I am getting older, so I'm kind of trying to turn back into being a nice guy and just deal with stuff better. But as far as dealing with stuff and getting stuff done, sometimes you just got to be blunt.
All right, interesting perspective, Eric. Thanks so much for calling.
We'll go now to Ruth in Kenosha. Ruth, hi.
Hi, I am a traveling nurse, and I'm currently assigned to a hospital in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The first week I was there, I was absolutely appalled by the vulgar language and the use of the F word as if it was and or of or the. And I also think that the people there, for the most part, are extremely disrespectful of each other and to everyone. I have chosen, because I feel like I'm, in a sense, a guest at their hospital and only there for a short time, I have chosen to use kindness. I bring food. They act as though it is absolutely foreign to them. The first time I brought something, they're like, well, who brought that? They didn't even put a note who it was from. And I found the observation of that absolutely astounding, that somebody would find something negative to say about somebody who did just a kindness. So today I decided to bring brownies, and a housekeeper there that I talk with, who gets their number and has had their number for some time. We chat, and she said, you know what? They're, like, starting to warm up to your kindness. I do not expect that anything will change after I leave there. But for me, I am choosing at this particular place just to continue to use kindness, although it's very, very difficult. Right. I do speak up if there is something going on. The first week I was there, I heard back through the grapevine that somebody had totally backbitten me. I went to my boss and I said, this is what happened. And that person was talked to, and she has been very nice to me ever since.
All right. Well, I'm going to jump in because we've got a lot of other callers there, but thanks a lot for sharing your story, Ruth. And we never complain when random pastries show up here at Wisconsin Public Radio, name attached or not.
And that is the truth. All right. Well, thank you so much for that. And let's take a Facebook comment here. Tim on Facebook writes, all you need to do is look at the comments section of anything online that allows comments to know that people can be crass, vulgar, and hateful and rude. So looking there at what's happening online. And don't forget, you can join the conversation now. Do you think we are becoming much more uncivil? Are we in an incivility crisis? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And we go next to Ken joining us in Kiel. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I agree that the lack of civility in conversation is gone. I think people have a total disrespect for another person's opinion. Not that you have to agree with them, but you simply do not even give them the opportunity to express themselves. That the just an intolerance to anybody that's not your way. I belong to a Franciscan order, and we have what we call civility in discourse. And we ask for a commitment from anybody and everybody to have civility in discourse. We've done it in Washington with politicians. We do it within ourselves, within our order, and anybody that online can join in by making that commitment. And we have found that it has really increased the ability to converse with people, either one-to-one or in a group, by knowing that we're going to listen and let somebody have their voice. Not that you have to agree, but you're giving them respect.
Ken, I want to ask, what after you've been working with, say, politicians on this for a while, what do you hear from them? What do they say after going through this?
The majority of them are positive about it and wanting to do it. Very few have just turned us away, but the majority of them are willing to commit and sign on. Now, whether we haven't followed to see if they actually behave that way in political discussions or anything, but at least they're making it publicly known because it's available to see who has committed to it that we've agreed to be this way.
Ken, very interesting.
It's with the Franciscan Action Network in Washington, D.C.
Interesting. Ken, that's an interesting project. Thanks a lot for sharing it with us. We'll go now back to the phones. We've got Eric in Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hello, I just wanted to make a comment on regional civility, and I think there's a lot of truth to this saying Midwest nice. On my travels out east, I particularly found in the D.C. and Boston area that civility is lacking in daily interaction, and I'm reminded of a Bob Dylan lyric, the country I come from is called the Midwest. I also think earlier to one of the caller's comments on kindness, I'm reminded of a quote of Plato that everyone should remind themselves of daily is be kind, for everyone fights a great battle.
Oh, thank you. That's a really good quote. I like that, too. And Eric, I've always heard, maybe it's because I'm from Wisconsin, but I've always heard Minnesota nice. I'd like to think
I'm from Iowa originally, and I think it's really true anywhere in the region that Midwest hospitality and generosity is something we really take pride in here.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling with that, Eric. We appreciate it.
We'll go now to Jessica in Eau Claire. Jessica, just 30 seconds or so.
Hey, I just wanted to mention, and thanks for taking my call. I find it very interesting. I'm 25 years old. I've worked in customer service for a while, and lived in Wisconsin my entire life. I think that it's getting construed now that maybe kindness or friendliness is seen sometimes now as being naive almost, and that you almost have to be assertiveness, and maybe rudeness is now being very blurred with the idea of being assertive and blunt. And I've struggled with this myself, and I just wanted to comment that I've been called naive for sometimes doing things that I think is just kind or friendly.
All right. Well, Jessica, keep being kind. Thanks a lot for all of your calls today. We've been talking about incivility in America. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. That's at Central Time on WPR.
Representative Steve Noss says the state legislature is set to take up a bill that would make it more difficult to challenge Native American mascots and logos used by local school districts.
WPR's Rich Kramer joins us to explain what's being proposed. He's our regional reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob and Veronica.
So what would this proposed bill do?
Basically, it's in reaction to an Act 250 passed in 2009. The original law that we are under right now allows a resident of a school district who is offended by a race-based nickname, logo, or mascot to file a complaint with the State Department of Public Instruction. The state superintendent then reviews the case, and if he finds that it is indeed a race-based nickname or logo or mascot, then they have 12 months to change it. Otherwise, they could be faced with a $1,000 per day fine. Republicans have, especially Steve Noss, have been against this for a long time. So they've introduced, or they're introducing, a proposal now that would create some changes. And basically, the main changes is, instead of one person being able to complain, there would have to be a petition with signatures from school district residents that would need to equal about 10% of the school district's student population, and they'd have to collect those signatures within 120 days. Also, the hearing process would be very different. Instead of the DPI looking at it, the State Department of Administration's Division of Hearings and Appeals would hear it, and that is in response to claims that the DPI is biased against districts that have race-based logos, nicknames, and mascots.
So let's take that apart a little. I guess the theory is it's too easy to change it now, according to the bill sponsors?
Yeah, they basically are saying that, you know, the will of a single individual at this point, they claim, can override the due process of an entire community. Their claim is that it should be more representative, more of the community should have to speak out before they overturn a race-based nickname.
And was there something about an element of harm being done by this? I know we've talked to, I think, Barbara Munson. She was protesting when the Washington Redskins were in town playing the Green Bay Packers, and she was opposed to these mascots, saying it does harm to students, especially Native Americans in the state. What does Representative Noss's office say about that?
Representative Noss's office says that, you know, that's impossible to prove. That this bill, the challenge will still be available, but they have to prove actual harm, actual discriminatory, you know, conflict-type harm. And that would be a very difficult to prove that these nicknames are actually creating this kind of environment.
Do you have a sense of how many schools are still affected by this? How many schools have nicknames that might fall under this law?
You know, I don't. There are still a number of districts that have nicknames of this type. The one that has been in the news a lot is the Mukwonago School District, the Mukwonago Indians. Mm-hmm. And they have been fighting this tooth and nail. The DPI came after them in 2011. Some residents there filed a lawsuit claiming that the DPI's effort to take their nickname away was unconstitutional because those at DPI were biased in the case, and they didn't have the clear mind to make an honest decision. That went to an appeals court, which is overturned. They tried to bring it to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court denied it. And at this point, Mukwonago is still objecting to, and they're not complying with, the DPI order. And they're hoping that this legislation will make it will give them the pass that they need.
And without that legislation, they could be facing those $1,000 a day fines you mentioned?
Up to between $100 and $1,000 per day.
So this is something that has been with us for quite a while, this issue going back and forth. The legislation you mentioned goes back just a few years. Is this a debate that's going to go away anytime soon, do you think?
I don't think so. And if this law is passed, you know, and then if the Democrats take control of both houses and the governorship sometime down the road, I wouldn't be surprised if it goes back. One example is this issue has been going on for 20 years. And in Menominee, nearby Eau Claire here, about 10 years ago, there was some school board members that voted to change their nickname, which was they were the Menominee Indians. And that caused such a firestorm in the community that three school board members that proposed it were recalled. And then it came up again with this law in place. And the district then, last year, I believe, decided to preemptively change the nickname before they even got caught up in a hearing with the Department of Public Instruction.
Interesting. Now, the idea of moving it from the Department of Public Instruction to the Department of Administration, that's taking it from an elected, I'll put it in quotes, nonpartisan office to an appointee of the governor. Is that part of the motivation here, or has anybody said that that's part of the motivation?
Nobody that I've talked to have come out and said that explicitly, but that's kind of understood. It's understood that the DPI, Tony Evers especially, has come out many times saying that he is against race-based nicknames, logos, and mascots. So by taking that hearing power away from him and giving it to maybe a friendlier force in the governor's office, that's kind of the idea.
Can you give us a timeline? What happens now with this legislation?
Well, it hasn't. This is kind of an amendment that's being offered to a bill that Steve Noss introduced recently that would actually repeal the law entirely. I heard from his office that they had some pushback on the repeal. So this is an amendment that will be introduced sometime next week. And then from there, they're hoping that it can just kind of get speed along the process. But at this point, it's not even been introduced.
And assembly leadership looking to take it up, do you think?
Robin Voss is one of the people that was on the release, and he's one of the people that are applauding this bill. So I would imagine it gets a hearing pretty quickly.
All right, Rich, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Rich Kramer, WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Pour some sweet, 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 sweet cider in the glass. Another season's harvest.
That's Sweet Cider by the group Gathering Time. Thanks to Simply Folk host Stephanie Elkins for the music. We're talking apples now on this edition of Food Friday.
They're an American icon, and they're in season now. The apple is one of the most widely grown and eaten fruits in the world.
Over the last four centuries, 14,000 varieties have been cultivated. These days, we mostly just eat those basics. Golden Delicious, Macintosh, Granny Smith.
Well, here to explain how that happened and maybe why it's starting to change is Erica Janik, freelance writer and producer and editor of Wisconsin Life. She's the author of the book Apple, A Global History. Erica, thanks for coming by the studio.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Now, we introed by saying apples are an American icon. And of course, there's a saying, America, apples are as American as apple pie. No, that's not right, is it?
Close enough.
Anyway, apples, American, are they?
They are not. You know, I think that's something that's pretty interesting about the apple is that apples have really managed to make themselves at home basically all over the world, and so that they do really seem like a native fruit. But apples are actually from very far away from here. They're actually from Kazakhstan in Central Asia, and all of the apples that we know today come from this one mountain range in Central Asia. And it's really just fascinating to think of how they spread from this area and have really made themselves at home everywhere.
Wait, so all the varieties of apples that we know of today come from one mountain range?
That is correct.
That's mind-blowing. So wait, how do all those varieties end up on one mountain? And then, I guess, how did they get here?
Well, actually, you know, you talked about how there's thousands of varieties of apples. So apples kind of, the way that they reproduce, they're kind of like humans in the way that they do it. So, you know, when you have children, your children don't look exactly like you. And that's kind of what an apple tree does as well. So all of the apples that it produces are not exactly the same apple as the parent tree. So the apples that are actually growing in Kazakhstan are a wide variety of wild apple types. And as the apple has spread around the world, there's been thousands and thousands of new varieties, just as there's like thousands and thousands, millions of people. Mm-hmm. It's the same kind of idea.
And are all of those, you know, baby children apples, do they taste good? Or are some of them you think, oh, that's one I don't want to duplicate it again?
You know, they do. Some will taste good and some will taste bad. And that's really because if you think about a wild apple, kind of has a different agenda than a human. For a wild apple tree, their main objective in life is to reproduce. And the main part of an apple that reproduces is the core. Whereas for humans, we really want a lot of sweet flesh to eat. And so for an apple, that's kind of inefficient to grow all of that flesh. And so you'll find a lot of apples that actually are pretty small, mostly core, and don't taste that good.
So let's get to how they got to America. Was that Johnny Appleseed guy? Is that just a folk legend, or is that a real guy?
Johnny Appleseed is a real guy. His name is actually John Chapman, and he was living in Massachusetts in the 1700s, and he started moving westward, and he was planting apple seedlings, and he wasn't, you know, as I said, apple trees don't produce true to type. So he was actually just planting a bunch of seeds, and all these different varieties of wild apples were popping up all over the place. And in a lot of these states in the Midwest, which is primarily where he was, part of the rules of getting your settlement as a settler was that you had to have an apple orchard. And so he was very smart. He was kind of keeping ahead of that line of white settlement. And so settlers would get there and he would say, well, I already have your orchard for you. And so he just kept moving and planted thousands and thousands of apples.
So was he just economically savvy, or was he like obsessive about the apples?
A little bit of both. He was also a Swedenborgian, which is kind of a nature worshiping religion. And so he actually saw planting apples as part of spreading his faith.
Wow.
I've never heard of that faith before.
It's named after Emanuel Swedenborg. Maybe you should have a whole segment about Swedenborg.
I was just thinking that. Exactly. Well, so we were talking earlier, too, about, you know, how for a long time it seems as though we just had these few varieties of apples that you get in the grocery store, like your Macintosh apples, your Granny Smiths. That's starting to change. But what happened where we had just these few varieties in grocery stores for so long?
Well, that's actually kind of a newer phenomenon. That's really a 20th century thing where you'll only find about, what, maybe 10 varieties of apples? Because in the past, apples were a really local specialty. There were local varieties that people just had in their town or in their backyard or were known in their state. But as apples became a real global commodity, it's just more efficient to only grow, you know, one type of apple in your orchard. And so commercial apple growers were really looking for apples that could transport well overseas, that remain shiny and crisp and sweet, because that's what they thought people wanted. And really, the looks were actually more important than how the apple tastes. And if you've had a Red Delicious, you know that it's not terribly delicious. but it looks absolutely beautiful. And it's been bred to look absolutely beautiful. And so this is why you don't really find a lot of apple varieties. But this has been starting to change. People are more interested in these heritage varieties. And so you're finding all kinds of orchardists all over the country and all over the world that are kind of bringing back a lot of these older varieties and rediscovering them. You know, sometimes there'll be an old apple orchard or an old apple tree just growing on a piece of land or in a national park. And, you know, that's really allowing us to tap into our apple heritage.
How long have apples been a big deal here in Wisconsin?
Apples have really been a big deal maybe since the late 19th century. Growers actually had a hard time getting apples to grow here in Wisconsin because our climate is quite cold, and apple trees would often die off. And so there was a lot of investment in apple research in about the mid-19th century, and they were looking at kind of Russian apple varieties. And you find a lot of the apples that come to Wisconsin and Minnesota are these kind of Siberian apples that obviously can survive very cold conditions. And so this kind of feeds the apple industry in Wisconsin. And by the late 19th century, Wisconsin growers are feeling, you know, pretty confident in their crop, and apples become kind of a big thing here in Wisconsin.
How easy is it to raise a productive apple tree? I'm assuming it's more than just dropping a seed in the ground and hoping for the best.
It's actually quite challenging to produce an apple tree. As I said, you know, apples don't produce true to type. The only way to get the same type of apple, so if you have a Granny Smith apple, the only way to get another Granny Smith apple tree is actually by grafting, which is basically cloning an apple tree. And so all of the apples that you're having, so if you have a Granny Smith, for example, every single one, every tree in the world, every apple is actually a clone of the original Granny Smith apple that was found by Maria Ann Smith, a real granny, in Australia in the 1860s. So it's kind of a fascinating thing about apples. And so they are kind of challenging. They do require a lot of care in order to actually get the variety that you're hoping to achieve.
Now, you said that's starting to change, that we do have these, you know, core varieties of apple, pardon the pun, but and there are all these heritage apple trees out there now that are flourishing. Tell us about some of the new kinds of apples that we're starting to see.
Well, I think, you know, we're seeing some new but very old apples. I mean, one of the ones that you'll find sometimes at farmers markets in Wisconsin is the Wolf River, which is actually a Wisconsin apple. It was found in the 19th century and was pretty common in Wisconsin in the 19th century. But then you really didn't see it anymore other than maybe some farmers that still had one on their property. But you're starting to see more of them. And I think that's pretty exciting. I think you're just seeing a lot of the return of some of these older varieties. There was a Milwaukee apple, for example, and there's a group in Milwaukee, Slow Food, that's actually trying to bring back this Milwaukee apple. So that's one of the ones that you're going to see. You'll also see some English varieties, things like the Cox Orange Pippin. These are varieties that were, you know, really widely popular in the past and are really starting to make a comeback.
Well, historically, apples, and even today, apples aren't just for eating. What were early Americans doing to drink the apples?
Most of these apples actually were being drunk and not eaten. And so in colonial America, really the beverage of choice was hard cider. And this was in part because almost everyone had an apple tree. And an apple tree produces way more apples than a normal person can actually eat. Maybe there's someone who can actually eat all those apples, but way more than a normal family can actually consume before they start to go bad. And so a great way to preserve your apples is to turn them into hard cider. And they also happen to be very easy to turn into alcohol, because if you mash them up, they pretty much start bubbling and fermenting fairly quickly. And so you find all over colonial America, everyone is drinking hard cider. Children are drinking hard cider. Adults are drinking hard cider. President John Adams actually had a glass of hard cider every morning because he considered it good for his health. And, you know, at a time when milk was unpasteurized and water was often polluted, hard cider was kind of a safe choice. And this really was a very popular drink through much of the 19th century.
Now, Erica, I know that besides being a passionate historian, you're also a passionate cook. And I wonder what is some of your favorite stuff to do with apples that you pick?
I like doing something so, so basic, but I just really like making apple crisps. And it's in part because I'm lazy about making crusts. But I also just think a crisp is really a fantastic way to highlight a lot of delicious apple flavors. I also like baked apples. What else have I done with apples? I'm making applesauce too. I think applesauce is so easy to make. And, you know, I remember always buying it at the store and then realizing that I could make it in just, you know, a matter of minutes, basically. And it tasted so much better. And, I think that's something that almost anybody can do just with a pot.
I'm a big fan of making crisp, again, due to crust laziness. What kind of apples are your favorites to put in a crisp?
My favorites, I actually like to do, I'm a big fan of the sweet tart apples, both for eating just out of hand as well as for baking. But when I am baking, I do like to have a combination of some of the really just sweet apples and then pairing them with something kind of crisp too. So something like a Granny Smith for that crispness and tartness. And then, you know, maybe something like a Jonathan, which is more uniformly sweet. It doesn't really have that crisp edge. A Pink Lady also has a little bit of crispness to it, but they also pair very nicely together.
I love the apple names. They all kind of sound like bands to me.
The Pink
Lady, and then what was the Cox Pippin something?
Cox Orange Pippin.
Cox Orange Pippin. I love them.
Yeah.
I don't know. Where do the names come from?
Lots of them come from the place where they were found, the person who found them. Some of them are, you know, some of the words actually, you know, refer to various things. Apple seeds are often called pips, so the pippin. Yeah, you know, I think it's just kind of a lot of these apples were found by somebody. So it's almost, you know, like naming a star or whatever. Like you just name it after you know, whatever inspires you in that time.
You know, we were talking about being a lazy cook. Do you feel like you have to peel the apple to use it? I hate peeling apples, but I love apples and I love baking with apples, but I'm not a fan of peeling.
I do not peel my apples.
Good.
Generally, though, if I am getting, you know, there is, apples are a fruit that is very prone to a lot of insects and disease. And so depends on what kind of apples you're getting and how you feel about that. But, you know, you do, some people do peel the ones that you'll find conventional apples in the grocery store because they might have more pesticides on them than ones you might find at your farmer's market.
Are they still coming up with new kinds of apples today in our last 30 seconds?
They are definitely still coming up with new kinds of apples. Actually, the race to produce new fruit is just as intense as the race to produce, you know, the newest phone or the newest, newest bit of technology. It takes a long time to do it, though, so perhaps it doesn't seem as lightning fast as other things.
All right. Well, Erica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Got some bacon to do this weekend, I think all of us here. Well, that was Erica Janik, freelance writer, producer, and editor of Wisconsin Life. She's also the author of Apple, A Global History.